Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Helen Crane. And coming up, as airlines continue to cancel hundreds of flights over staff shortages, is this another year for a staycation? We explain what your rights are if your holidays are disrupted and other tips on beating the summer chaos. Plus, is it time to get a mortgage from a small building society that you've never heard of, as cheap rates from local lenders undercut the big banks? Crane is back on the case as one reader asks, can Bulb really charge me £2,000 for energy going back 4 years? And they may be more expensive to buy, but with petrol prices soaring, how long does it take to save money with an electric car? Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, quite understandably, many travellers are a bit peeved of late. Around 34,000 customers have been told their June holidays out of Manchester Airport had been cancelled, some in overnight emails. That's just one airport and one travel company, TUI. This week alone, 1,000 EasyJet, British Airways and TUI flights have been axed, with experts predicting the disruption could continue into next year. Simon, just when you thought COVID was sort of done in terms of holidays, that we could get away and enjoy stress-free a couple of weeks in the sun. Alas, no. Why?
Well, before we start, I would like to...
Technically, we've started already, but...
Yeah, anyway. Before I start talking about that, I would like to take my hat off to British Airways.
Okay.
For having the sheer nerve to send an email out yesterday, presumably to me and other customers, saying, plan a holiday to remember. Whatever the purpose of your visit, it's the memories we create that make it special. Whether it's an early morning walk along an unfamiliar street, an afternoon spent getting lost in a bucket list city, or a sunset so spectacular, no photograph could ever do it justice. No matter where inspires you, we can take you there, including a queue that snakes the whole way round the airport while you try to go on your first holiday for 3 years and discover that your airline has woefully oversold tickets for flights that it cannot deliver on, and your half-term holiday with your family has been ruined.
Yeah.
I made the last bit of that email up. They didn't say that. But, you know, I mean, what on earth are these airlines playing at? I have an element of sympathy, which I may go into in a minute. But firstly, they know how busy they're going to be this week, because half term, everybody knows when it is, and everyone's known when it's going to be for at least a year. The Jubilee bank holiday weekend with the double bank holiday, everybody knows that that was coming up. The lack of COVID restrictions, they've been around for a while. And actually, it's pretty obvious that they weren't going to come back this time round. But this is where we err into the element of sympathy thing. It was really, really obvious that it was going to be really, really busy this week. And do you know how they know how busy it's going to be? They sold people tickets and they can count them. They have like a clever system now, the airlines, where they can count how many people they sold tickets to. So they can go, oh, yeah, actually, we're going to have a load of people traveling this week. So they had a lot of time to get ready for this, and it's completely blown up in their faces. The problem is that they have decided to engage with this issue by just cancelling an absolute ton of flights. Compounding that, they then seem to have taken an attitude where they're going to ignore the bit where the rules say if they cancel your flight, they're meant to put you on the next one available. And there are horror stories coming out of people not being offered replacement flights, or being offered replacement flights at a time when it makes going away completely pointless. Mm. There are holidays being cancelled all over the place. There are people spending hours in airports. I really feel for anybody who has got stuck in all of this chaos this week. Now, I should say that there are people who've managed to go away with no problems this week, but there are lots of people who have managed to get stuck in absolute chaos. And I really feel for people, because holidays are really important to people. They put a lot of effort into it. They put into planning it. They put a lot of money into it. they hope for them. And they think it's time to start creating new memories, as British Airways said in its email to me. And these are not the memories that they were hoping for. Now, the element of sympathy that I have with the airlines is they are really suffering due to a lack of staff. But I don't have much sympathy there because they sacked a load of people. They sacked a load of people when they had furlough money coming that meant that they didn't have to sack people. And what they did was they sacked a load of people on the basis that they thought they could always get them back. Lo and behold, turns out they couldn't get them back. They are paying the price for years of not treating their staff as well as they could have done and not paying them as well as they could have done. And now they are desperately trying to catch up at the same time as they have sold a ton of tickets to people, knowing that actually they really, unless there was some kind of miracle, couldn't fulfill that. They're trying to blame the government for security checks. Now, there's a blame game going on between the government and the airlines. I'm going to guess that there's some blame on both sides. The government isn't exactly covering itself in glory and the civil service with anything like security checks, driving licenses, passports, all that kind of stuff at the moment. So I imagine that it's not going so well. But the airlines know that their staff have to be massively security checked. The only element of sympathy I do have for them, and where I think that there is definitely a finger to be pointed at the government, is that the government, until very recently, appeared to be hell-bent on bringing the travel industry to its knees. Yes, it brought in restrictions to deal with coronavirus, and yes, perhaps they were necessary, although it has since been found that maybe a lot of those weren't necessary. But let's not get into that conversation. What it did was it constantly moved the goalposts on the travel industry to the point where they just thought everything was going okay. Oh, yeah, we're going to pull that rug away again. And so it's no wonder that the travel industry didn't get itself prepared properly and didn't spend the money on getting itself prepared properly, because it's been repeatedly shafted over the last couple of years. Having said that, to treat your customers in the way that they've been treated is absolutely terrible. And it's basically made everybody think that maybe flying anywhere this summer might be a bad move, and that it's only going to be worse during the summer holidays, because they look at the airlines, they look at the government, they look at whoever else is to blame for this, and they think, I'm stuck in the middle. What are the chances of it getting better by the end of July?
So here we are again, Helen. Is it another summer of staycations? Are there any barbecue equipment and hot tubs still left to buy? Probably secondhand, actually, from the first time round. But where do you think the fault lies here, Helen? Should the government have kept furlough going on for longer, or should travel firms have hedged a little bit better and not sacked all their staff back last summer and then realised they don't have any when things pick up?
Yeah, I mean, not sacking tons of their staff would probably be really helpful. I think it's really difficult, and I think we're going to see this in a lot of different industries, because people who worked for airlines in airports, a lot of those people either lost their jobs or decided to leave the industry because they saw what happened during COVID, all the disruption, all the job insecurity. They don't want that. They've left the industry, and the airlines and airports and holidays, they need to sort that out. They need to pay their staff better or find ways of getting them back, because I think the issue is I've got friends who worked in like the leisure industry and in restaurants, and a lot of them during COVID just decided, actually, don't get paid that much. You know, I work bad hours, and actually I'm just going to go and do a different job where I get probably paid more and treated better. And I think in a lot of these industries that are really hit by COVID, they need to sort out how they treat their staff and how they pay their staff, else these staff shortages are just going to carry on, and it's just going to be even worse for customers.
I would like to point out that I have immense sympathy for anyone caught up, as Simon said, in this as travellers. But I also have immense sympathy for frontline staff, if we're talking about staff, who have to deal with people who are incredibly, understandably tired and irate. So I have a huge amount of sympathy for them. But Helen, is it not time for the travel industry, therefore, to take a look at their practices, their pay? And there will be people, obviously, who've got new jobs now and can't just drop that and come back. But why not appeal to those people that they sacked and give the conditions that would be better to entice them to return? Or is that going to cause even more problems?
I mean, I suppose airlines would say, we've lost loads of money during COVID, so we can't necessarily afford to be throwing loads of pay and benefits at staff to come back. But I mean, they're just going to lose even more money if they keep having to cancel flights. I mean, if your flight gets cancelled, you should get all of the money back. And the cost of cancelling a flight, I imagine, practically to the airline is huge as well. So
I'll ask you about the rights in a minute, because they can get very expensive. Simon?
Well, one of the issues that the airlines have got is that they have to obviously do security checks, and security checks are pretty tight. And that's good, because you want security checks on airline staff to be pretty tight, because the alternative is pretty bad. You don't want to be flying on a plane. Oh, well, at least I'm going to get to Greece. But, you know, they don't really know who's working on it. The problem is that some of their staff have gone off and done other jobs in the meantime. They might have done multiple jobs. And in order to do the security checks, they have to check up on each job that the staff has done. And some of this is taking them a very long time. So there was talk that the government might throw open easier ways for them to do checks on people, rather than the old fashioned, you know, reference request goes through to someone, did this person work here and all that kind of stuff, and were they a problem? That was one suggestion they might be able to do. But like you said, so I remember early in the pandemic, I was in my local co-op and I was talking to the woman on the till. She said something. She said, "Oh, it was only my first couple of days." I said, "Oh, right." You know, she said, "Yeah." I said, "What do you do for this?" She said, "I was worked for EasyJet." I said, "Oh, right." And I must admit, because she was serving on the till in the co-op and she worked for EasyJet, I thought that she must have been a stewardess. I said, "Oh, right. What did you do for EasyJet?" "I was a pilot." "She was a pilot?" I said, "Oh, right. Have you not been furloughed?" She said, "No, we were just sacked." Like, we were just given notice. She didn't say sacked. It's like, what are you doing? It takes ages to train a pilot. Pilots to train. She'd spent loads of money getting herself trained, and she's a female pilot as well. They're not that many of them. They're meant to be trying to get more of them into the business. So I mean, there was a lot of this stuff that went on, and if that's happening to the pilots, you can imagine what happened to the cabin crew. And airlines are woefully understaffed, and it's not just the cabin crew on the flights, it's the whole airline staff element, from people checking people in to the baggage handlers and everything like that. And as you said about those frontline members of staff, I flew back after a long weekend with my wife. We'd gone snowboarding earlier this year in February. We flew back from Zurich, which is a major airport. Okay, we're not talking little foreign airport. We're talking major, major international hub. We checked in for the EasyJet flight and there was a massive queue, and there was two people behind the desk trying to serve this massive queue for what was originally a couple of flights. And then and because you're coming back from somewhere, you know, which is near to the mountains on a Sunday night, you've got loads of people coming back with baggage. They're checking in bags. Now, again, very little sympathy for the airline, because the airline knows exactly how many people are checking in bags, because you've got to pay to check them in. You've got to book them. You don't just turn up with them. It's very rare that people just turn up with bags on an EasyJet flight nowadays, because they charge you a fortune to do that. And this poor woman, these two poor women are dealing with the queue. And then one of them stands up and puts her jacket on. Everyone's like, "What's going on here? What's going on?" And then she came out, she started to talk to people in the queue, asking about flight to Madrid. Oh, right, she's just checking about people flight to Madrid. She got the people coming to the flight to Madrid to come to the front. And then she walked off because she'd finished her shift. Everyone thought she'd just walked off because she'd finished her shift. Actually turned out that she'd walked off because she needed to get on a plane to go somewhere else. So she had no choice but to stick around. It left one member of staff dealing with the entire queue of people, a whole plane full of people she had to check in. And the plane was obviously delayed for a couple of hours because they couldn't check all the people in order to get them through. And yeah, she had to deal with lots of grumpy members of the public, who actually, broadly speaking, were quite well behaved. But this is rolling itself out at airports and flights and, you know, days of this week across the country. So yeah, I definitely have a massive element of sympathy. And the problem is that, as Helen said, the airlines can't get the staff back quickly enough, and the staff just don't necessarily want to come. EasyJet were offering people £1,000 sign-on and retention bonuses. But I mean, I think even in some instances, that's not going to be enough for people.
I just worry that this is, you know, in that small instance that you just mentioned there, I mean, that's a security risk for her own person, but also for the flight to not be able to be checked properly. And it just is extraordinary that they've got to a situation where on the Jubilee weekend, they're cancelling flights sometimes less than 24 hours. Some people don't even know. They just turn up at the airport. Helen, I mean, it's an extraordinary situation. But let's talk about what your rights are if your flight is cancelled or even delayed, because that can also get very expensive for the airlines.
Sure. So you do actually have quite a lot of protection if your flight is cancelled or delayed. The issue is going to be whether you can actually get on another flight, because if everything's delayed, everything's going to take a lot longer. Even if you get offered another flight, that might be delayed. So this is where it gets complicated. But at a basic level, you're entitled to, if your flight is cancelled, you're entitled to travel on the original day of departure if there's any commercial way of getting you to your destination. So your airline has to offer you another flight with them. They, if that's not available, they have to offer you a flight with another airline, and they can even offer you a flight from another nearby airport. So say if you're in Newcastle, you're prepared to go to Edinburgh, they can offer you a flight from there. They're also supposed to pay for your travel to another airport, but it's usually on National Express, so how many people would take that up, I don't know. So that's, you're technically entitled, but that's obviously going to be difficult when loads of flights are cancelled and delayed, but that's what they're supposed to offer you. If that's not possible, they can offer you an alternative flight for another day, but it's up to you if you take it. You know, if you're just going away for a few days and they're offering you a flight the next day, maybe it's not worth it. You're entitled to cancel it and you should get all of your money back.
Tell me about the compensation.
Yeah, so it really depends on how far you're going and how much your flight was delayed. So the compensation is for delays, not for cancellations. But you can get up to £520 is the maximum that you can get. And that's if you're traveling on a flight that's more than 5,200 miles and it's delayed by more than 4 hours. If you're not traveling as far, it's not as much, it's about £100. But decent amount of money, worth claiming. I do think with things like that, all of these kind of delays and compensation claims at the minute are so backlogged because of everything that happened during COVID. You know, I get emails from people who are still trying to claim refunds and compensation for flights that were cancelled and delayed in like April 2020. So while you should be able to get money back, everything is taking so long at the minute, and this is only going to make it worse. The one thing I would say is, in a situation like this, always worth having decent travel insurance, because that just gives you another option. The airline's kind of not playing ball, you're finding it difficult to claim, they're kind of digging their heels in. Decent travel insurance should help you out, and also they can also help you out on the day at the airport. You know, a decent policy might cover, you know, if you're willing to fund a new flight yourself, a decent travel insurance policy will pay you the money back for that. So it's really, if the last couple of years have proved anything, it's really, really worth getting decent travel insurance when you're going on holiday.
Absolutely. It can get quite complicated in terms of compensation. You have an article on your website that will walk you through that. So do take a look if you are impacted by that. And I would say, I know it is a ball ache to go through it, but, and I will not bring you back your holiday or make it any less stressful, but you are entitled to probably to some sort of compensation, or at least you have rights. So make sure you do exercise them, no matter how difficult it is. Simon, Helen spoke there about travel insurance. I think we spoke a couple of weeks ago, was it, about the really high costs of car rentals abroad. Goodness me, there's so many issues that could come up that we weren't expecting. We thought COVID was the big thing, and that's still not gone away, let's be honest, or monkeypox is it now. Are there any other tips that you have for us for a less stressful summer to get away? Because holidays are important. They're so important. They're ingrained in employment law. That's the only, so anyone who says, oh, it's just a holiday, it's not just a holiday, it's important. But is the answer, Simon, a staycation in your home for another summer?
Not if you really want to go on holiday. If you really want to go on holiday, then I think you should try to go on holiday. I mean, I say that as someone who managed to go on holiday last summer and the summer of 2020. So, you know, we managed to escape the country. It is doable, even at times of heightened stress. Mm-hmm. It was legal to leave the country on both of those occasions, just to be clear. Yeah. Isn't it funny that it was illegal to leave the country for quite a while?
And well,
we're going to look back at some of those rules so strangely. So as Helen said, one piece of good news is and this really is a piece of good news, is that those EU flight compensation rules that actually caused the airline industry to up its game somewhat, because it used to be much worse on the old bumping people off flights thing. Those EU flight compensation rules were put into UK law after Brexit. So that was one of the Brexit things where we wrote EU laws into our own. So you are protected. And it depends on the distance. And it's if your flight is delayed more than 4 hours. And also if it's cancelled within 14 days of your departure. And so that's good news. The knock-on effect, obviously, for a lot of people is, what if you can't get there? What if they don't put you on another flight? What if they be a bit rubbish like they are at the moment? What if it's actually no point going on your holiday and therefore you lose the money that you've spent on your hotel or your villa or your car hire or all those other things? That's where your travel insurance kicks in. So first thing, make sure you've got travel insurance. Make sure it's got a decent level of cover and that it's good travel insurance. We've written a guide to how to get the best travel insurance this week. If you go to thisismoney.co.uk/holidays, you will find that and the guide to the flight cancellation stuff there as well. Read both of those. So forewarned is forearmed. I think make sure as much stuff as you book as possible, and this is definitely a lesson from the last couple of years, is cancelable with all of your money back, or that they're offering some form of guarantee if for whatever reason you can't make it. I mean, there is still the risk that you get COVID and you can't go on holiday. Make sure that maybe try to fly on non-busy days. And I apologize to anybody listening to this who just tried to travel this week and is tearing their hair out listening to me. But maybe if you're booking your summer holiday, think, let's not go Saturday to Saturday. Is there any way that we can go even Friday to Sunday makes a difference. But if you can do Friday to Friday, if you can fly out on a Sunday, fly back on a Monday, for example, those are good. Obviously, if you do like Tuesday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Wednesday or something like that, that makes a big difference. The tricky thing is, if you are looking for accommodation, a lot of accommodation wants to go Saturday, Saturday, but you can find stuff that doesn't go Saturday, Saturday, and it, you can ask. And actually, quite often people will say yes. With car hire, make sure you compare prices. There are a number of different places to compare car hire prices. I won't go through all of them. I often use Holiday Autos. There's car rentals as well.com. There's loads of places. Compare your car hire. Again, a lot of that, if you go through the comparison sites, is much cheaper than if you go direct to the car hire companies. The car hire companies were meant to have wised up to this and started offering much more competitive prices. I've not discovered that personally. And also the advantage of going with some of those comparison sites is quite often the car hire is cancelable until the last, until 24 hours beforehand. So you might be able to cancel it. You might be able to move it. Check closer to the date just to see whether there is cheaper car hire, because that can happen. Car hire is very expensive at the moment, but things move around, demand and supply and all that. You might suddenly find you could save some money. Don't take the excess insurance at the desk with the car hire company. That's very expensive. Get yourself a policy that covers you before you leave here, or you can do it through some of the comparison sites where you compare car hire, but quite often you can get a worldwide policy from here that's the cost of maybe 2 or 3 days of the excess insurance at the desk, and it will cover you for a whole year. So do that. And quite often the policies are better. Can you go on holiday without getting a car? Lots of people do. Can you go on holiday somewhere you can walk everywhere? Can you go on holiday somewhere you can get a train? If you don't fancy the airports, do you want to risk it with the Eurostar or the Eurotunnel or a ferry? Maybe don't use P&O. We used DFDS at Easter, and I thought they were excellent. Little things like, and again, don't go on the Saturday. Don't go Saturday to Saturday. Watch out for, if you're driving in France, watch out for the Saturdays, the busy changeover days, and never drive home on the last Saturday of the summer holidays or drive on the first Saturday of summer holidays. It's absolutely awful. There's all kinds of things like that, but maybe try to build in a little bit of a buffer into your travel plans where you every step that you book something, you think, am I giving a little bit of latitude for something to go wrong here?
Good advice there, Simon. Good advice. Helen, anything from you? Any tips on how to get some good travel insurance?
Yeah, so a few things you want to look out for. First thing, you know, this isn't really anything to do with delays, but your medical cover is often the most important thing because that's where costs can just skyrocket massively. So you want to aim for at least 5 million on the emergency medical insurance. Lost and stolen possessions, another thing, you probably want about £1,500 for that. And then on the cancellations, basically you want it to cover as many different types of cancellations as possible. So issues with flights, airlines, hotels, you can even get policies that will cover you if you get COVID and can't travel. And you want something that covers, obviously, the total cost of the holiday. You know, worst case scenario, you don't go, you want to make sure that your policy will give you all the money you paid back.
Right, well, let's move on from holidays. I'm sure we'll be talking about it a lot more as the summer goes on. But when it comes to a mortgage, those looking for the cheapest rates and best deals usually end up with one of the big banks or a major building society. But in recent weeks, we've started to see some of the best rates on offer coming from small local building societies, the likes of which the average borrower might not have heard of. So in this instance, is it a case of better the devil you know, or should you take a punt on the little guy or gal? Simon, what are we witnessing?
Bit of a shake-up in the mortgage market. The big banks have taken a bit of a step back after being extremely gung-ho over the last couple of years and offering some absolute cut price rates to people trying to chase down mortgage borrowers because, quite frankly, they were trying to make some money and they were pretty flush with cash and they were very eager to lend and the property market's going up. Things are looking a bit more shaky at the moment. The house prices are still rising at a clip, up 11.6% or something over the past year. It's just a small matter of another 27 grand on the average house, according to Nationwide. But there are concerns that things might turn. Cost of living crisis, looming recession, the fact that house prices have gone up by so much in recent years and people can't afford to pay much more, affordability calculations, all those things. So they're being a bit more cautious at the moment, which means that they're winding their necks in a little bit. There's less of the mortgage price war going on and more of the slow crank, 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 crank up of mortgage rates hitting people. But into that gap has stepped the smaller, more nimble players who can be a little bit more conservative in their thinking, but can also go, right, hey, we've got, you know, X amount of mortgages that we want to write. And so all of a sudden you can find a lesser known name jumping to the top of the mortgage best buy tables. And will it last? It happens every so often. And it usually depends on what the appetite of the big banks and building societies is for lending. But certainly at times of a little more fragility in the market, it can last for some time. But Helen has some excellent tips for what to think about when you're going with one of these.
Before we think about that, what are you talking about? What rates, Helen? Who are these unknowns? What were they offering in comparison?
They're pretty decent rates. They're so much higher than, you know, you'd be looking at if you were taking out a mortgage kind of 9 months ago, but in the current climate they're okay. So say you're wanting to buy a £200,000 home, you've got a 25% deposit. The best two-year fix for overall annual cost is not the lowest rate, but this is what, you know, the deal on which you will pay the least year by year. It's with the Cambridge Building Society, and that's 2.54% with a 199 fee. So today's climate, that's a pretty decent rate. It's a low fee. They've also got the best 5 year. So that was a 2 year fix. They've also got the best 5 year fix, which is 2.69% again with a 199 fee. Some of the other ones that are offering good rates are Hanley Economic Building Society, Loughborough Building Society. People probably haven't heard of some of these, but they're worth a shout for some people at the minute. You know, if you
legit. You know, there's nothing to be concerned about, or is there?
Not really anything to be concerned about necessarily. There are some things you want to think about if you're going with one of these smaller players. So for example, things can be a bit slower. They obviously don't have as many staff, and if they're offering a good deal, they might get a bit of an influx of applications. So be prepared for a broker that I spoke to talked about the risk of a slow no. So you apply for a mortgage, it takes them, say, 5 weeks to get back to you, and then it's a no, by which point you know, with rates going up at the minute, you might have missed out on your good rate and you're kind of back to where you started. So you want to be aware that it might the process might be a little bit more clunky and take a little bit longer. But people do generally say, you know, these smaller building societies tend to rank better for customer service than the big banks. I mean, unsurprisingly, because the banks rank so terribly, but it's a bit more of a personal service. People often say it's their criteria can be a bit less rigid as well. So where the big banks often with applying for mortgage can be a bit of a sort of computer says no situation. Their initial sort of affordability checks on people done on computers, you know, it can be a bit of a tick box kind of exercise. With the smaller ones, they do what's called manual underwriting. So a real life person will look at your application and they might be willing to kind of bend their criteria a little bit in certain circumstances if they still kind of think that you're a good candidate. So there's all pros and cons to big banks and the small banks, but for some people it can work a lot better.
So our survey says
it's decent sharp. It depends what you're looking for. And another thing to mention as well is if you like to do your mortgage sort of administration in person, maybe it's not the best idea to take a mortgage where, you know, you live in London, you're with a building society in Staffordshire, you know, kind of think about that as well. You if you want to go to a branch, maybe don't take a mortgage with a tiny building society hundreds of miles away.
Right then, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at the markets. Sam, it's a pretty short week on the markets this week because we don't have Thursday and Friday. We're recording this on the Wednesday, I should say, for all our listeners. And in America, they didn't have Monday. So what's been going on?
Yeah, that's right. Memorial Day on the Monday. And the week before that was pretty remarkable. We saw 6% gains for the NASDAQ, Dow Jones, S&P. And then the FTSE and DAX were up 2.6%, 3.4% respectively. So it's been an interesting start to the week because history shows us following 6% weeks, the markets will be considerably higher 12 months from now, 80% of the time. So there are signs we might be starting to find a bottom finally. However, Eurozone inflation came in today or yesterday at 8% or 8.1%. US manufacturing came in pretty high as well, which might be a bit of a worry for those wanting to get inflation under control. So far this week, you've seen markets take a little bit of a breather following the massive gains we saw last week. But eyes will be on the latest jobs numbers, which comes out on Friday from the US to try and give us a bit of a further direction.
And what do we have coming up next week?
Yeah, from a data point of view, we have some Chinese data, which will be important from a supply chain perspective. Now we're starting to see them open up a little bit more. We also have announcements from the ECB ahead of their imposing rate increase in July and also the Reserve Bank of Australia. I think they're Tuesday. Elsewhere, we've got Chinese inflation numbers midway through the week. But the main focus is going to be on the US inflation number on Thursday. Have we peaked? Have we not? Rightly so, the majority of the market focus will be on that. And really from then it will be, we could start to see the real direction of the market for the coming weeks from there. So eyes on that, US inflation on Thursday.
Okay, Sam, well, thank you very much for joining us. Speak to you next week.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Now, electric vehicles are getting more popular, especially with rising petrol prices, but they are still more expensive. So when, Simon, will the figures start to add up? Or do they? How popular are we talking here with electric vehicles, Simon?
Figures this week revealed there are now 750,000 electric vehicles on Britain's road, except they're not electric cars or trucks or buses as such. These are electrified vehicles, so they include plug-in hybrids as well. So there are less pure electric cars, but there are a lot more electric cars on the roads than there were 2 years ago. If you know what you're looking for and you look around, you'll see lots of them. There's a lot of VW ID3s, the small Volkswagens. There's lots of Peugeot E208s. There's tons and tons and tons of Tesla Model 3s. There's quite a few Tesla Model Ys now. There's quite a lot of electric Audis. You're seeing electric BMWs. MG has been revived by the Chinese with cars that in no way resemble the old MG sports cars of old, but quite a few of those are electric and they're proving quite popular. Wander around London and you'll see that there are now loads and loads of electric taxis. There's even lots of electric vans out there delivering all of our shopping to our doorsteps and so on and so on and so on. So there's definitely been a boom in sales and it is going to continue going on. The difficulty actually for most people is if they want to buy an electric car, they have to wait a very long time to get their hands on them.
Exactly. Explain.
Well, if you want any new car, you're going to have to wait a very long time to get your hands on it, in all honesty. But there is a global chip shortage, and that is feeding through to car makers, because our cars are essentially gigantic computers nowadays, and they can't get enough chips to make the cars. And so they can't make the cars fast enough. And they've got other supply problems, ranging from getting stuff over from China to wiring looms, which a lot of that stuff comes from Ukraine. So the big problems there. Anyway, the upshot of this is that we're banning purely petrol and diesel cars in 2030. People who are going out buying a new car now are much more likely to go out and consider buying an electric one. They are more likely still to go buy a petrol one. A lot of them are now buying hybrids, but they are much more likely to consider an electric one than they would have done in the past. They cost quite a bit more money, though, is the only thing.
How much are we talking about here, Simon?
Well, it depends on the car. You can be looking at maybe a £5,000 premium, roughly, on the equivalent petrol-powered car. So, for example, Vauxhall's Mokka E is £5,000 more expensive than the same model in a 1.2-litre petrol version. Peugeot's E208, again, £5,000, £7,000, or something like that, a bit more expensive than the petrol version of those cars. And if you're looking at it purely from a money-saving point of view, it's going to take you a long time to make that money back if you're looking at what you're saving on petrol and tax. So obviously they're zero rated for road tax. Mm-hmm. So broadly speaking, if you do about 7,000 to 10,000 miles a year, you're probably going to save about £600 a year on running an electric car. You don't need to do a particularly complicated piece of maths to work out that £600 a year on a £5,000 difference takes quite a long time. Roughly speaking, you're looking at maybe 8 to 10 years before you break even on the savings on the petrol. However, what you need to remember is that most people don't buy brand new cars cash in their entirety. They buy them on PCP deals. They buy them on finance deals. And on a finance deal, the difference can be quite a bit smaller, because effectively with a PCP finance deal, the really popular finance deals, what you do is you put down a deposit and then you pay a monthly payment for a set period of time, often 36 months or 48 months. And then at the end of it, you have the option to buy the car yourself with something called a balloon payment or final payment. That's the chunky piece of money. The deposit, you're going to put down roughly a similar deposit for an electric car as you will with a petrol car. Maybe a little bit more, but it's not going to be a huge amount more. The monthly payments, what they're doing is covering the projected depreciation of the car over that period of time. So over the 3 years or the 4 years. Now, the depreciation on electric cars is slower than it is on petrol cars. It's definitely slower than it is on diesel cars, if you can find a brand new diesel car for sale nowadays. So you're effectively funding a smaller loss in value with those monthly payments. So the gap between the two monthly payments suddenly starts to narrow. Then if you look at the amount that you're saving each month on petrol, so say, for example, it costs you roughly £15 to £20 every time you fully charge your electric car, versus it's costing you £80 to fill up your petrol car, you're obviously saving quite a bit of money there. There's the little bit of road tax money that you're saving as well. You start to narrow the gap between the two monthly payments to quite a bit, but still often the electric car can be that little bit more expensive. But then the other thing that comes into play is that a lot of employers nowadays are offering salary sacrifice schemes, which allows you to buy an electric car, do a PCP lease deal on an electric car, and you pay for that from your pre-tax wages. And you're only allowed to do this without being heavily taxed at the back end by the government on a limited number of things, which it considers to be worthwhile and good. So you can do it on your pension. Your employer can set up your pension payments like that. So you automatically save on the tax and national insurance on that. Obviously, you get tax relief on a pension, so it's kind of just reflecting that. But it is better for people because you save the national insurance as well. You can do it for a bicycle. Most people will be aware of the Cycle to Work scheme. And you can do it for an electric car. And it used to not be worthwhile doing, because there's a benefit in kind tax that comes at the back end. But that was knocked all the way down to zero a couple of years ago. It's now gone up a bit. I think it's either 1% or 2%. I should have found out the exact detail before I started talking. It's either 1% or 2%, but it's minimal. So it means that actually, if you factor all of those things in, no petrol costs, the depreciation isn't quite as bad, so the monthly payments not as bad as the price gap actually looks, no road tax, and then you might be saving 33% or 43% tax on it, then the gap does start to narrow down quite a bit. And also, you've got to remember that many people want to buy electric cars because they would prefer to have a car that is not polluting in the same way. It must be said that making cars is highly polluting and bad for the environment. So making brand new cars, that has an environmental cost. Okay. Whereas with your old car, that's maybe 10 years old, the environmental cost of that has been sunk many years ago, amortized over the 10 years, however you want to describe it. Whereas if you junk that and go out and buy a new one, there is an environmental cost there, but there's less environmental cost in terms of powering it. And people will go, well, what about the power, like generated from coal-fired power stations? Well, you know what? Sign up to 100% renewable energy tariff. And yes, the energy going directly into your car has not only come from solar panels, but your energy supplier, if you choose a good one who does it properly, will have had to pay for as much of that energy to be generated from renewable sources. And so, yes, it is less polluting in that way.
Simon, are we ready for 2030?
No.
Right, okay, fair enough.
But the good news is that it's only 2022. So we've got 8 years to get ready. And as a nation, we are really good at getting ready for stuff that we know is going to happen. Just look at what's going on at the moment with the flights. It'll be totally cool.
All right.
The public charging network is expanding at pace. That's one of the concerns. If everybody switched to electric cars now, would we have a problem in terms of energy generation? Yes, almost certainly. We're meant to be, you know, upgrading our energy generation. Obviously, energy is a big issue at the moment. Electricity prices have spiked, but even with the electricity price spike, you pay between 7 to 14p per mile for an electric car versus 26 to 40p per mile for petrol. The thing that's going to happen is they're going to change road tax in some way, because the more people driving zero rated cars, the less money that the government is getting in car tax or vehicle excise duty, as it's officially known. And we're probably going to end up shifting to some kind of pay per mile system. And then somewhere down the line, you know what's going to happen with all these low emission zones that have been brought into cities, where you can drive an electric car in them, or you can drive cars after a certain point. The shift in car ownership is going to roll on to the point where now everybody's allowed to drive in them. So they'll have to cook up some new rules for those, and they'll just become charge you to drive your car zones. It doesn't matter what car you'll be driving. And people will get grumpy about it, but they'll probably keep doing it.
Yeah, probably. All right, Helen, Simon spoke about energy there. You've been back on the case this week, and it's about unreasonable energy bills, but not just energy bills that are going up, which is what most of us will be experiencing at the moment. Helen?
I get emails at the minute every single day from people who say that their energy suppliers have mischarged them. You know, this could be £100. In some cases, it's thousands of pounds. And this is just errors that they've made on bills. And it really worries me because, you know, is this happening because people's energy bills are going up and a lot of people are on their phone to the energy supplier? I imagine the energy firms are really, really feeling the pressure. So are these mistakes happening more because the energy firms are so busy, or have these mistakes in bills always happened and people are now just picking up on them because the sums are higher and they're noticing the hit more on their bills? It is something I really find quite concerning. So this lady who's written in, basically she moved house, and this is often where these issues come up, is when someone moves house and isn't transferred properly, the kind of final bill isn't done properly. So she moved in May 2021. Her supplier was Bulb. He's obviously now gone into special administration, but they're still running as a firm for the moment, kind of backed by the government. So she let Bulb know. They sent her a final bill saying she'd used £2,354 of energy. Her account was in credit and she got the credit back, moved on, thought it was all fine. But it wasn't fine, because about 6 months later, in January of this year, She changed to a new energy supplier in her new house, but she got another letter from Bulb saying that she'd actually used £4,287 of energy in the period that her final bill related to. So yeah, bit of a difference.
Yeah.
So she's about £2,000 in debt to Bulb, they now said, and they were demanding that she paid within 14 days.
Having previously said that everything was fine.
Yeah.
Right. Just to be clear.
Yeah. I mean, several issues with this. The main one, arguably, is that under Ofgem rules, energy firms actually aren't supposed to back bill people for energy used more than 12 months ago. So they're not allowed to charge you for any gas or electricity you used more than a year ago. No matter what mistakes they made, no matter how wrong it was, there's a year kind of cut off. This bill that she had with Bulb, part of it related to energy that she used about 4 years previously. So rightly, she queried this with them. She said, you know, I don't think you should be able to do this. And they just fobbed her off. You know, sent her these sort of generic emails saying, oh, you know, this is what kind of standing charges are and things like that. And they actually told her at one point that they could back bill for 2 years, which isn't true. And, you know, she was doing all the right things. She was asking them for breakdowns of the old bill, the new bill, meter readings, the prices per kilowatt hour, and basically an explanation of how this ended up happening, which they just never gave her. It's really not on. You know, she was just asking for an explanation and they repeatedly sort of refused to give her one. I got in touch with them and luckily after a bit of back and forth, they agreed to clear her account. So she doesn't have to pay anything. She can move on. No more letters from Bulb, which is good. I mean, they kind of phrase, oh, this is, you know, out of goodwill. It's not out of goodwill. They made a mistake and they should never have been able to charge her for energy used more than a year ago.
They lied. They said it was 2 years. Did they not? Bang to rights. They no.
Yeah. I mean, one of their customer service kind of call center people said to her, oh no, we can actually back bill you for 2 years, which was just, you know, isn't the case. I hear things like this all the time. And I think people just need to really be on top of what they're being charged because mistakes seem to be happening all the time. You know, do your meter readings, really check your bills and think, you know, how much is this per month? So that's the thing. When she got her second bill, that would have meant that she was paying just under £400 a month for her energy bills. And, you know, she lives in, I think, a 3-bedroom house, semi-detached house, turns the heating off in April. That's even with today's high bills, there is no way she would need to be paying that much. And it's just about sense checking it. You know, people shouldn't just look at the bill and think, oh, well, you know, bills are high, so I must owe that. No, like do query. It's really important at the moment with bills going up so much.
I mean, obviously, Helen, given your role, you're exposed to a lot more of these sort of practices than I am, but I'm still just, I'm horrified by the fact that even if someone does question these things, and absolutely rightly, they could be given absolute rubbish in response, which is just blatantly not true, which makes you question. And it's just, the number of people you said, you know, you wonder whether these mistakes were made before or whether energy companies are just desperate to claw some money. I sort of sense it's probably a bit of both. But how many of these have gone under the radar? How many people have just gone, oh, okay, maybe it is 2 years, I'll pay the money?
Yeah, I mean, I imagine this has happened to loads of people and, you know, people who it's smaller sums and I mean, almost quite rightly, who can be bothered? I mean, people are waiting on the phone for hours to speak to their energy company. And it's, you know, for people who are fortunate enough to be able to, you know, still comfortably pay those extra charges, quite rightly, for the sake of, I don't know, 50 quid, I actually can't be bothered to try and call my energy company every day for 2 weeks and be on hold for half. It's a terrible situation. I mean, these energy companies are still making plenty of money. They just need to hire more staff in their call centres.
They do. Simon?
I think there's two concerning things about this case that Helen investigated, discussed it, you know, in the office, is firstly, even after Bulb came back, after Helen had investigated it, it came back and came back to the customer and made this, gave a bit of talk about goodwill. And one of the bits of talk about goodwill that it was implied in their letter or email that it was goodwill, was that it was only going to go back to February 2021, right? But that was only what it was allowed to do. That's the Ofgem rules. It's only allowed to go back 1 year. Those are the rules. That wasn't a gesture of goodwill. It's just the rules. But then it gave her a £400 goodwill payment. But even after that, the bill was completely wrong. So it covered February 2021 to May 2021 when she moved out. And when you worked it out, as Helen said, it she'd have spent £390 a month on energy. And that's just wasn't, you'd have had, you know, back then, now it's probably possible, but you'd have to have quite a large inefficient house. And she said she didn't have one of those. So even then it was just completely wrong. But there was definitely a point there where it was like, well, here you go, you can do this. And she would have paid, you know, she would have paid up and gone, oh, okay. And actually was suddenly paused for a moment and went, hang on a minute, this still doesn't look right. And secondly, going back to the beginning of this Crane on the case, is I think it's really important to remember that this has happened to someone who's had to come to us for help, and Helen has very much helped them, who was totally on top of the scenario. They got this, they got this back bill, and then they got onto the energy company and they kept went backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and challenged and challenged and challenged and asked for all the right things and all that kind of stuff. And still they got nowhere. Still Helen had to step in and help out. And for every person like that who has gone backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, as Helen said, there's lots of people who would have just paid up or not realised or just gone, oh, it's too much hassle. Bulb kept saying, well, we'll give you a payment plan. You can pay it back over a period of time. They would have gone, okay, all right, I'll just pay it back £100 a month, whatever. I just need this to stop. I'm worried because Bulb was threatening them with debt collectors. At the same time as Bulb isn't answering their questions, Bulb is threatening them with debt collectors. And let's remember that this is the same Bulb that's in special administration as effectively in state ownership. Let's not forget that bit. And then also, you know, for every person who actually keeps challenging that kind of scenario, like the filter then narrows down even further for the point where they actually come and contact us for help or something like that. So it's the tip of the iceberg. This is happening to loads and loads of people. And as Helen said, you know, the energy sector is in disarray, and we are getting rafts of emails about people's bills being wrong. And yeah, it's really not good enough, especially at a time when we're all putting our hands into our pockets to support to try and support elements of it that have gone under because they were very badly mismanaged.
Indeed. But Helen, you do a naughty and nice list every week. So, I mean, should we lighten up the tone before we let everyone go and say some positive things about companies? Do you have any this week?
Yeah, go on then. So it's actually it's another energy company, Octopus. I'm not saying they're perfect because I do also get emails with complaints about them. But in this case, they've done right by a customer. So this is the reader, Gary, and he emailed me to tell me he was seriously impressed by Octopus Energy. And actually this did kind of start with a mistake, but this is an example of a company admitting they've made a mistake and setting it right. So basically his energy contract, he was on an Octopus smart tariff, fixed in for I think a year, and it was about to come up for renewal. Obviously at the minute, a lot of people aren't renewing their fixed contracts, they're dropping onto the default contracts because they're actually cheaper. But your energy company should let you know when your fixed tariff is about to end to give you time to decide what to do. It didn't, should have sent him an email, it didn't notify him in advance. So he then got another email from Octopus saying, because we've got to send this email, we're actually not gonna we're going to renew your fixed tariff at the same rate as it was before. So he's not going to have to drop onto a default rate. He's not going to have to take another fixed tariff. He's essentially, I mean, I don't know what his energy bills are, but that is a huge win at the moment. So he'll be on a tariff which he went on to last summer when before this all happened. So that will save him a huge amount of money. And it's just nice to see a company saying, you know, we screwed up, but here you go. We'll sort it out and we'll do something quite nice. So fair enough, Octopus.
Nice, a bit of energy yin and yang there. Well, thank you very much. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to listen to all podcasts past and join in the debate and reader comments. And happy Jubilee weekend to all of our listeners. Enjoy the Queen's Jubilee. Raise a glass to 70 years on the throne. Whether you are a supporter of the royal family, not that fussed, or a Republican, someone has done an amazing job for 70 years there, and we should tip our hat to them for all the times that we complain about the people not doing amazing jobs. So well done, the Queen. Nice.
Well done,
one.
The Queen, Her Majesty.
She does listen to the podcast, I understand.
Obviously, big fan, so I'm told. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.